Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 30th of March. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I am Charles Archer.
Mother's Day already. Can you believe it? Mother's Day. How's everyone doing anyway? What's been going on this week?
I don't know. The world's in chaos, so that is every week, seems to be. But otherwise, the weather's good. That's nice. Yeah. How are you? What have you been up to?
Yeah, very good. I'm a bit of an epic road trip at the moment. I'm in Denmark, of all places. I've gone through six countries in 4 days. So started off France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, and then I'm now back in Denmark. But yeah, it's been fantastic. The weather's been brilliant. There's been some amazing scenery, and it's been fantastic. What about you, Charles?
Me, I sorted out my office this week. I put a nice picture of a boat behind me, which looks nice. I bought a cactus.
That's not looking
my
good.
My house
man.
Is almost a house now.
Setting it up for the video, aren't you? You wanted to get the room some nice talking focal points.
Well, exactly. You want to look a little bit more professional. I'm even wearing a shirt today, believe it or not.
Kev, how's things? You're up on the warm coast, I believe.
Yeah, I'm on the Mediterranean coast here. It's been cool. It was cool when I first came up here, but got very warm and been in the 30s on Thursday, and then cooling down a bit and then warming up again. But I was in the Mediterranean Sea for a dip on Thursday. Boy, it was Baltic. But it was really nice. After 2 or 3 minutes in, beautiful. Though I only stayed in for about 5 or 6 minutes maximum, I think, but it was good. I enjoyed it.
Well, I mean, I've been away, guys, so you're going to have to fill me in on the news. I've not prepared anything, mainly because I've been keeping the phone off, and I've not been... I saw a couple of alerts related to... Was it Rachel Reeves? Rachel from Accounts, as Charles likes to refer to. Give us an update on what has happened in this spring statement.
Tell us what has happened, Charles, on the fact that all their numbers don't add up, and it's never going to add up, and the interest rates are now ticking up, and they're going to go up again, and our mortgages are going to go up again for sure, without doubt, and her balanced budget is just not going to balance.
3 million people are better off.
Raise taxes from somewhere, and I don't know where it's come from. But anyway, you say what you think.
Oh, okay. So basically all of that's pretty much covered it. But she raised taxes a few months ago, and then everyone decided they weren't going to employ as many people anymore. So there's no jobs. But she's going to cut benefits, particularly for disabled and sick and elderly people, which you know, mathematically probably makes sense, but not if they can't find a job so they can survive. And she's a bit of a moron, really. It seems to be the case. I mean, she accepted Sabrina Carpenter tickets, you know, for free, which, you know, looks politically awful. Free clothes looks awful. You know, the credit cards that she's been given and abused, awful. Lying on her CV, awful. She's useless and incompetent, has to go. Any of this stuff in the private sector should be gone immediately. But because she's Chancellor, it's completely fine. And, you know, they spent like £85 million a year. They created a new budget, effectively to make the government look good. And there's this video of her sort of strutting out of the building. And it's just, you look at her and you just go, out of her depth, incompetent, useless, go away. Anyway, that's my very professional review of the budget. But basically, it's kind of irrelevant now, because if they increase taxes, it'll reduce the income the government gets in, because we're way past the curve anyway. And if they cut spending, it'll send the economy into a recession. So
we are way past that curve now, right? Every increase is not going to get you more tax, it's going to get you less tax.
And I think
they know that now. I think, was it them that basically said that our growth rate is now predicted at 1% instead of 2%? And that's quite a slash, you know, a 50% reduction in growth. And they had to put that down to circumstances in the world, or that's what they were trying to say. But the reality is they just sucked a whole load of money out of the economy through tax rises. Mm-hmm. And therefore the growth went down. And employers decided, you know, I'll use John, my biscuit man, as an example. Does he employ 15 or 20 more people, or does he buy a robot? He buys a robot.
Yeah.
And you know that means he's going to pay less national insurance, and the thing doesn't moan, and he pay and it works 24/7, 365 days a year.
I
End of
think,
story.
yeah,
Well,
I
it's
mean
all doom
that's
and
it,
gloom,
you
isn't it?
know.
It's all doom and gloom, it feels.
Well, it's a bit doom and gloom. I mean, the other thing is, we're still one of the strongest economies in the world. London is still a financial and legal powerhouse, but you just get the sense that if we just had a tiny bit of competence in our political class, and this isn't Labour or Conservatives or Lib Dems or Reform or any, it's all of them. There's just such a lack of talent, just universally. If we got some talented people in charge, we'd probably be able to reverse it very quickly. But we don't have talent, and so we're just kind of a bit stuffed. The problem is there's nobody to vote for. You know, if there's an election tomorrow, who do you vote for? Nobody particularly stands out as being able to run the country properly. And it kind of makes sense because I would never want that job because who the hell would? Anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, I was in England though, obviously a week or 10 days ago, and I actually couldn't believe. And I mean, I've been to obviously been last year and the year before and everything else, but everything just seemed a lot more expensive. I don't know why. And I mean, obviously, I'm not comparing everything because I'm only just talking about whether you eat out for a meal or you buy yourself a drink or you know you have a snack in the train station. It was just expensive. I couldn't believe it, really, to be honest.
I think it's the what it feels like in the UK anyway is that the middle classes have stayed static in terms of their earnings haven't increased. But the working classes and the minimum wage in particular has risen and risen and risen, whereas the median wages haven't gone up. So you have this case where, graduate income salaries are a pretty good example. 20 years ago, there was a very big difference between a graduate salary and a minimum wage job. Now there's very little difference. You know, the minimum wage is 24 grand a year if you're working full time. How many grad jobs are paying 25? And so you have this situation where, the vast majority of the country is earning between 25 and 35,000 a year. And then there's not many jobs higher than that. And then there's the big leap, and everyone, you know, the small percentage over 100,000, and that's it. And so you have an economy built around that. You know, if you go to eat out, the people eating out, they're either students with student loans or higher rate taxpayers. And everybody else is trying to struggle to pay their mortgage
Yeah.
and their energy
Interesting
bills.
you mentioned about mortgages because they did a review and they said that you think it'd be London that has got the affordability problem, but actually it was Wales that because of the wages in Wales for first-time buyers, that there was like three cities and towns in Wales that were one, two, and three on the list. I think then Blaby in Leicestershire was like number four and five, or Northamptonshire, and London was coming in around fifth or sixth. So it was very interesting how house prices are obviously lower in those areas, but the wages are significantly lower
Yeah.
than London wages. So they're like, 10 to 1, 15 to 1 on earnings to mortgage
It's
ratio.
crazy, isn't it? I mean, the irony of it is in two of those areas in Wales, one of the biggest ways people acquire housing wealth, if you were born there, is through inheriting the family farm. Hang on, no, you can't do
Hang
that
on, yeah,
anymore.
you can't do that anymore. Yeah.
Oh God, it's just a disaster. But I mean, the housing is the source of all of the country's problems, not just the UK, actually, like most of the Western world. Because if the majority of your income is going on housing costs, whether that's, you know, paying off the capital or the interest, you can't put it into the real economy. If housing costs were a third of where they are now, imagine how much bigger the economy could be. Obviously, the only way to do that is to massively restrict immigration, which hasn't happened, or to massively increase house building, which we can't do. So we are in a pickle.
Let's move on to our guest this week. We're delighted to welcome back Rick Rule. For those who don't know Rick Rule is the president and CEO of Rule Investment Media, a legendary figure in the natural resources and commodities investment space with decades of experience. So, welcome back, Rick. How's life treating you?
Life's treating me very well, Phil. Thank you for asking. The better for being back on with you and talking to your audience through the medium of you.
So, I mean, it's been a little bit of a while since you've been on Rick. I mean, we've seen a lot of changes in the world, obviously, most notably Trump 2.0. I just want to hear your thoughts on the state of the nation that is the US right now. I mean, we obviously see it from a completely different side of the pond with the British media. I mean, in the 70 days that he's effectively reshaped the US landscape, he signed over 70 executive orders, including pardoning January 6 rioters, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord and the World Health Organization. and imposing large tariffs on China, Canada, and Mexico, and then the latest one with the EV and basically motor manufacturing 25% tariffs, which impacting global trade and US consumers. So how do you feel about the way things are going in the US with Trump 2.0?
In my 72 years on Earth, I haven't faced a politician in my life that I liked, Mr. Trump being no exception. Some of the things that he's done have been useful. I think pulling out of some of the large multilateral organizations that don't do anything other than cost taxpayers money and restrict the lives of individuals are good. And I think the theater around Mr. Trump and the Department of Government Efficiency is good. But I think it's theater. You'll notice for all the talk of the discovery of fraud in the system, no charges have been brought. So I wonder how much charge has been, how much fraud has been found. For the $1 billion that have allegedly been saved, I notice that the government is operating on a continuing resolution which raises the debt ceiling. And the budget that they brought forward has the sixth largest quarterly deficit in history. One wonders how efficient that is. For me, past is prologue. I'm good friends with and am having, as a political keynote speaker at my conference, David Stockman, who was the director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan Revolution. For those of your listeners who are old enough to remember, Reagan had a very broad mandate, not a hairline victory, to reduce the size of government. And David Stockman wrote a wonderful book called The Triumph of Politics that details how the Reagan Revolution was derailed by political forces, Republican and Democrat, in Congress within 6 months of the inauguration of Ronald Reagan. David Stockman has subsequently wrote a book said how you actually cut $2 trillion from the US federal budget. But people hate math, but it's very, very, very worth reading. So for me personally, The Orange Man is more about theater than anything else. I believe that politicians are to be endured, not embraced. I suspect I'll outlive him. And I suspect that irrespective of what he does, I will organize my own affairs better than most people will organize theirs. So I'll do fine. Do I hold out hope for him? No. Has he done things that I dislike? Absolutely. Tariffs are taxes, and taxes suck. I also believe if you're going to try to do something, at least in my life, you try and do things one at a time. The idea that you make 200 enemies, seems to me like you prepare to lose 197 fights. I personally would prefer to win one fight at a time. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, it's really
I'll tell you
interesting.
something else. People react emotionally to stuff like Trump. I've learned in 50-something years of investing that the most identifiable risk that I can find, the biggest risk for me, is very conveniently located to the left of my right ear and to the right of my left ear. And while Trump is an amusement, and yes, to be sure, a risk, the risk that he poses to me relative to the risk of my doing something stupid emotionally means that he's a second class risk and I'm still the first class risk. And so I worry much more about what I might do to myself than what he might do to me. You'll notice that I'm not looking for him to do anything for me. I note that even before him in the Biden administration, there has come to be a growing awareness about the role of natural resources in American society. I'm amused that 5 years ago in the administration, as an example, as a uranium investor, I was vilified. I represented Chernobyl, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Three Mile Island, and now the morons want to subsidize me. I have to say, I felt cleaner personally when I was vilified than now when they're preparing to subsidize me.
Yeah, that's
I
very
hope that
interesting.
puts
Yeah,
my views in perspective.
absolutely. And I really like that you brought it onto the uranium and the resource sector. I mean, how do you feel about his sort of statements regarding Greenland Obviously, we know that there's a lot of natural resources there. And then also his attitude towards the Ukraine, talking about the vast resources, the rare earth metals, even though Ukraine isn't actually massively, endowed with the likes of these critical minerals and reserves, rare earths. What do you make of this sort of land grab attitude?
I think he's appealing to the dumber part of his base, the American nationalist in a country the size of the United States that's historically been as successful as the United States. We can afford to allow a lot of dumb people to vote. They exercise that, and I think Trump enjoys playing to that base. I don't think he's bothered to ask too many people in the Ukraine or Denmark or Canada how they would feel about US sovereignty. I suspect that the answer, particularly with him at the helm, would be not good. But maybe my favorite political leader in the last 100 years was Kemal Ataturk, the person who was responsible for taking Turkey from feudalism to a modern country. And I remember he coined a phrase that said, many friends, no enemies. And Trump seems to have a policy of many enemies, few friends. That doesn't seem to me, I'm no politician, I'm just a businessman, not highly intelligent. I've built two fairly large, or helped build two fairly large retail investment franchises in my life, both one over 250,000 customers. And I didn't do that by disenfranchising large parts of the population. Now, admittedly, there's something different between building a bank or building a wealth manager and running a country. But, the idea as a young man that you could walk around swatting hornets' nests with a stick, the fact that you could do it doesn't make it smart. And I don't think that antagonizing half your own country and most of the rest of the world is particularly smart. Probably amusing. And some of the people that he's antagonized doesn't hurt my feelings,
But it's not even smart, is it? I mean, the whole point of politician is you're governing the whole country. And what he seems to be doing is appealing to, maybe a third of his own base who are quite extreme. But you're meant to be governing for everybody, and he's not doing that. That's going to end badly for him, I imagine.
I don't think that the country will fare particularly worse under him than it did under Biden. There's a lot of sound and fury. As I say, the whole theater around the Department of Government Efficiency, I read the book, The Triumph of Politics. I know how this ends. Elections are, as Mencken suggests, advanced auctions of stolen property. And the high bid has changed. I get that. I get that Trump's game is to reward his friends and punish his enemies, the same as Biden's was. What's unique about the United States, perhaps, is that we're still, despite our amazing stupidity, we're still a society where five or six kids can take over a garage in Sunnyvale, California, and out pops Google or out pops Apple. But what I guess I'm trying to say is that for at least 70 years, our individual creativity and tenacity has financed our collective stupidity. And my suspicion is that the next 8 years won't be any different. It's just that the noise that scares people will come to from a different source, and it will be a different type of noise. The aggravation that you face will be different than the aggravation that you used to face. I don't think that the aggregate aggravation will increase or decrease. I just think that a different group of people will be aggravated and will react in a different way. As for me, I'll try to find asset classes that are cheap and buy them. I'll try to find very, very, very high quality, hard working people and invest in them. Not much will change.
Well, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. If you want to buy a house, if you want to start a business, if you want to do most of the things to get on with life, they generally don't help you. The best thing they can do is get out of the way.
That's right.
However, something that Trump has done recently is a presidential order to increase American mineral production. And that was only in the past few days. To what extent is that actually going to increase production in the US? Or do you think it's more of a smoke show?
Yeah, I mean, he said he's going to do 100 things. If he said he was going to do one or two or three things, sure. I'm a show me guy, right? He has some political capital to spend. But if you have political capital, you get one thing done. And then you go do a second thing. Because every time that you back a policy measure that has big enemies, that has enemies, you spend political capital. His political capital, the expenditure of his political capital, is too diffuse. If, as an example, he was going to focus on getting the Keystone Pipeline done, that would be great for me. It would be great for the United States. If he was going to focus on reducing the regulatory logjam around resource projects over $1 billion in capital expenditure, say the Resolution Copper Deposit in
30
Arizona,
years.
which is now
30
27
years.
years in permitting, that's great. But if he's going to dilute that with trying to take over Greenland, what's the probability that he's actually going to succeed in anything? I would suggest low.
Unless it's things people actually want done. But in America, getting anything done is a nightmare because for every one person that wants it, there's two people that don't.
I mean, the great thing about America is that by accident, sometimes the government doesn't get around to something and they leave it to individual Americans who tend to do a hell of a job privately. If you remember, and the government makes a lot about this, the ARPANET was the originator of the internet. It came out of the Defense Department. It was a government program that then the government forgot. Mercifully, because they forgot it and got out of the way, it got turned into something. And believe me, didn't get turned into anything by the Department of Defense.
Don't
It
know. I
got turned
think.
into something because the government got out of the way. Private people picked it up and they turned it into what it is today.
Well, the long-running joke is that whenever the government shuts down, that's when the US actually gets stuff done.
Correct. Correct.
But it's I don't know. I think this is the thing. You're right. He's splitting his political capital. So he spread way too thinly to get anything done. And then I guess the other thing is really it's the way he's governing. It seems to be almost through executive order, and how much power those actually have and how much of it is just words.
That's really been part of the pollution of American politics since at least Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The most important political document ever written, I think, was the Bill of Rights. And the idea that any individual issue where sovereignty wasn't reserved by the Constitution for the state belonged to the individual. And we've been backtracking about that ever since. In the United States, we set up a tripartite government with an executive branch, a legislative branch, and a judicial branch. And the idea was to slow the flow of idiocy. Executive decree is meant to short circuit the checks and balances.
Yes, exactly.
And going back at least to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the executive has done his best to obviate the Bill of Rights and the separation of power in favor of policy prescriptions. But Trump is no different. The flow of executive orders increased under Clinton, went absolutely crazy under Obama, and was pretty active under Biden. The big objection to executive order is the fact that the other guys got to make them for the last 12 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Rick, gold, gold, gold.
So let's do that.
$3,093 as we speak.
Let's do that in the context of Trump. I replayed the last interview that I did with you guys, and it's worth doing. For once, we got most things right. And
You mean you got most things right? We didn't really say
well, the
that much.
questions
Couldn't
went
get a word in.
the right way. Gold traditionally does well when people are concerned about the maintenance of their purchasing power in conventional savings instruments, in fiat currencies, but in particular in the world's reserve currency, the US dollar. The gold price tells you all about how confident people are in savings instruments in the US dollar. There are people who suggest that the Department of Government Efficiency is going to balance the budget and reduce the debt. And I would suspect that those people are smoking something that is still not federally legal in the United States. the
Alan's budget in the US would be a miracle, I think. A miracle
well, I
from.
mean, the on-balance sheet liabilities of our government exceed $36 trillion. But the bigger problem, and we discussed this the last time I was on your show, is the off-balance sheet obligations, Medicare, Medicaid, federal pensions, military pensions, Social Security. That number, according to the Congressional Budget Office, not some fat, old, bald, cranky libertarian named Rick Rule, but rather according to the enemy itself, that number, the net present value of that number exceeds $100 trillion. So the net obligations of the US government, including to US citizens, exceeds $130 trillion, while the Internal Revenue Service, or in my mind, the Infernal Revenue Service, estimates that the private net worth of American citizens is $141 trillion. Meanwhile, the on-balance sheet liabilities of the US government increase by $2 trillion a year, and the off-balance sheet liabilities of the US government increase by $2 trillion a year. Now, would that not make you concerned about the maintenance of the purchasing power of the US dollar?
Well, the net result of that is that America is currently worth $0. Then is that that's basically what we're saying, or near enough?
And you can see a historical precedent for this. If you look back to the decade of the 1970s, in the 60s, the US had fought two wars, the war on poverty, which, by the way, we lost, and the war on Vietnam, which we also lost. And we couldn't raise revenue because the highest marginal tax rate in the United States was over 80%, and we couldn't stop spending. So what we did, according to the Office of Management and Budget, is that in the 10 years between 1970 and 1980, we reduced the purchasing power of the US dollar by 75%. Not coincidentally, the gold price increased from $35 an ounce to $850 an ounce. Now, I would suggest to you that part of that rise had to do with the fact that gold had been price controlled. So I give the market the move in gold from 35 bucks to 100 bucks. But as the purchasing power of the US dollar declined by 75% over 10 years, the gold price went up eightfold. And in this circumstance, I think past is prologue. I think the probability that the US government deals with debt and deficit, that they actually cut federal spending programs, is nil. Zero. Another piece of arithmetic that we covered the last interview, but some listeners won't remember the last interview. The market share of precious metals in the US market is almost nil. One half of 1% of total savings and investment assets in the United States is allocated to precious metals and precious metal securities. One half of 1%.
You
The
imagine if that
four
went up to even 2%, what would happen?
decade mean is 2%.
Ah, there you go.
Four decade mean. So gold doesn't have to beat the S&P 500. It doesn't have to replace Nvidia. The US dollar doesn't have to go to zero. The US Treasury market doesn't have to blow up. None of that dramatic stuff has to happen. All that has to happen is for interest in gold to recoup its four decade mean. And if that happens, demand for the stuff goes up fourfold.
And the price
I
of gold
think.
goes to $10,000 at least, you would imagine.
I mean, if gold goes to $10,000, and I'm right about the deterioration of the purchasing power of the US dollar, in real terms, the gold price doesn't go up at all. In
Yes, I
nominal
agree.
terms, it goes up three or fourfold. And that's my case.
But do you not think that actually Trump is trying to batter down the dollar because he wants the lower dollar?
Well, that's another great point in favor of gold. If you look back to the decade of the 70s and to a lesser extent of the 80s, all of the major trading blocs were trying to reduce the value of their currency. The Japanese have done it for 60 years. The Chinese have done it. The Europeans have been particularly successful at it, perhaps inadvertently. Gold is the only medium of exchange that doesn't have a domestic political constituency for devaluation.
Well, here's a question for you, Rick.
Sure.
If you want to invest in gold, right, which a lot of people do, how would you advocate it? Because there are some concerns, say that the US dollar does devalue, gold rockets. Some people don't trust, the
I think
ETFs and the
there's three
ETCs.
ways to invest, and it really depends on who the investor is. I don't think there's any one size fits all. It is a mystery to me why anybody wouldn't own physical gold. I think it's like insurance. It's like owning life insurance or auto insurance. It is political catastrophe insurance. And it's very difficult for me to understand why somebody wouldn't own that. A little bit of gold goes a long way. Had you in 1970 had 5% of your portfolio in gold, you could easily have lost 50% of your bond holdings and 50% of your equity holdings and broke even at the end of the decade on 5% of your portfolio that was involved in portfolio insurance. So I don't see any reason why anybody wouldn't own physical gold. I think it's malfeasance with regards to your own family not to maintain
Agreed.
your purchasing power in physical gold. For those people who have capital left over to invest, buying the highest quality gold companies, not the flotsam and jetsam,
The fun ones. So
the best of the
give
best.
us some examples, Rick, of some good juniors or some good gold
No,
companies at the moment.
I'm not talking
The
about juniors. I
majors,
mean the best of the
Anglo.
best, not the lame, the halt, and the blind. I'm talking about Wheaton Precious, Franco-Nevada, Agnico Eagle. If you can stomach some political risk, perhaps Endeavor. High quality companies that have very good returns on capital employed, and in particular have 10 or 15 year track records of generating more net present value on the margin they produce competitors. In my experience, when we come into a gold bull market, and I think we're about a year into a gold equities bull market now, there's enough beta in the market, which is to say the gold equities market outperforms the broad market by enough that you don't need to take too much risk. You buy the best of the best and you relax. You just relax. Long about the time you're feeling really, really, really smart, you sell some. So we've done insurance, we've done investment. Now comes speculation. Most people shouldn't speculate because most people aren't willing to work hard enough to understand where the value is in speculation. And I would suggest to you that fully 90% of the companies that are involved allegedly in the gold business have no net present value. They're floating abstractions. If you aren't willing to do enough work to separate the lame from the halt from the blind, you shouldn't speculate, particularly because over the course of a bull market, you can make 250 or 300% on beta, which is you can make 300% on Franco-Nevada. Like,
Yeah.
why would you take on Amalgamated Moose Pasture or Consolidated Orangutan?
I can answer that for you potentially. Not now, but let's say you're in your late 20s and you're in an economy where inflation has gone crazy and house prices have gone crazy, and you don't have that enough capital left over after you've paid your essential expenditure. I think there's a lot of people who have to take that risk early on because they have no choice.
I've now graded almost 100,000 portfolios in 25 years.
Okay.
And let me tell you something I've learned from that. 90% of punters are losers. And by participating in a sector where they don't understand the risk and they don't do the work, they lose what little money they had left over. Now, I can tell you that all of the money that I now invest carefully and prudently, I made by speculating wildly. But I had 3 decades of 60-hour weeks. Most people's speculative technique is got a hunch, bet a bunch. They hear somebody tout some narrative that makes sense to them, but they never bother to determine whether the narrative is true. And that's probably a good thing because they don't invest enough in their education to understand whether or not the narrative is true. Now, that very gloomy picture that I just painted for you obscures the fact that 10% of the issuers, maybe five, generate so much performance that they add legitimacy to the 90% that are comprised of the lame, the halt, and the blind. And if people are willing to do the work, if they are willing to endure volatility and real risk, if they are willing to lengthen their time frame, from the next long weekend to 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, which is the period of time that compounding would logically take, there's a real argument to be in speculation. But having now graded almost 100,000 portfolios, what I've come to learn is that the number of people who should speculate rather than the number of people who do speculate is very, very small. I'm trying actively in my declining years through the rule classroom. We now have almost 10,000 people who have completed 9.5 course hours with us. Whether or not they employ the lessons that we teach is a different question. But my hope is that by the time I shed my mortal coil, that I will have taught 20 or 25,000 people how the game actually works.
For me personally, when I'm looking at speculating, it's always the management team, the geologists, the people. Because often, you can have 100 companies, say, out in the Paterson looking for, the next great gold deposit. It's the team behind them for me that
Absolutely.
I back
That's how you
rather than the
screen.
asset.
That's how you screen. We talked in our last interview, I don't know if you recall, but we talked about Pareto's law. We talked about the 80-20 rule. That's broadly understood and partly understood by the social science dictum that 20% of the population does 80%, generates 80% of the utility in any given task. What's less well understood is that this is a bell-shaped curve. There is a different 20% that generates 80% of the aggravation in any given task.
This is true.
So the first part of your job is to find the good, well, locate the good 20 and the bad 20, hang out with the good 20 and avoid the bad 20. What becomes more important for speculation is that in a fairly large task like mineral exploration, if you take either the good or the bad lip, the good performing 20 or the bad performing 20, and you run it through the same performance dispersal curve, the statistics conformably align, which means that 20% of the 20 do 80% of the 80, or 4% of the population generates 65% of the utility. What I've done being in the racket for 50 years is I've learned that the performance dispersal curve conformably aligns at least one more time, which is to say, just suggest that 0.8% of the management teams generate 40% of the returns. If, as you suggest, you focus on managements and you find people who have been serially successful, but serially successful at a task very closely related to the task at hand. If they're exploring for gold in West Africa, you want their past successes to be involved in exploring for gold in West Africa,
Yes.
not developing an iron mine in Western Australia, but rather success related directly to the task at hand. And they have to be your partners, not employees. They have to own enough stock that if they fail, it's going to hurt.
Yes, I agree on that as well.
If you do those two things and you add in an overlay of contrarianism, which is to say, when the market's going down very rapidly and you're scared shitless, you write a check to buy shares that are selling off aggressively that are run by, as an example, the Lundin family, or Robert Friedland or Ross Beaty. If you have the intelligence and the tenacity to do that, then speculation becomes much, much, much more predictable.
Rick, what about First Quantum in Panama? I'm changing the subject, but it looks like it's going to be happy families again, and they're going to get a chance to put that copper mine into production.
I bought a little bit of First Quantum. I regard that as highly speculative. I have to say, I like asking myself questions where the answer begins with when, not if. And First Quantum is an if question. I juxtapose the size of my downside, most of which has been recognized already, with the quantum of my upside. And it appears to me if I buy First Quantum today, first of all, I need to understand that although First Quantum is guiding to the fact that there'll be a quick political resolution, it'll take a year and a half or 2 years. So if I'm looking for wonderful things to happen, I need to plan on a time frame that's realistic, not one that's convenient to me. The other thing I've learned grading all these portfolios is that a lot of people have really intelligent strategies, but they're 5-year strategies and they apply 3-month tactics.
Yes,
If there's a
absolutely.
mismatch in terms of time duration between the time that's allowed for your thesis to play out and the time that you're willing to hold the stock, you're likely going to lose. So I'm expecting, with regards to First Quantum, that a resolution will take a year and a half. And if I'm right at today's copper price, I have a triple. And if I'm wrong at today's copper price, I lose 50%. Now, the juxtaposition of a 300% upside with a 50% downside, and I would suggest a 65% probability that I'm right, is not a bad speculation.
Yep, it's good risk reward, isn't it? And we're coming back down to speculation, but we talked last time very briefly about Zambia and these licenses that are in between Mr. Friedland's situation. And obviously, First Quantum is involved with African Pioneer, which is a very small market cap company that's in the UK, which has started to move in the last few days. What's your thoughts? Do you think Mr. Friedland's just going to come in and buy those licenses?
I don't think if he does that he will in the next 3 years. Robert is enjoying spectacular exploration success in the Western Foreland, in Congo, which he owns 100%. He has now spent about $80 million on reconnaissance, including RAB drilling through cover. The same exploration technique that he used to discover Kakula.
Yes.
And I don't think that you'll see that Robert has to spread his wings. If he does spread his wings, as opposed to buying those deposits, if you see a downturn, I think what Robert will do, Robert's really smart, is that he'll sign an exploration joint venture where he agrees to spend X amount of money and do a, and I'm saying, not saying he's going to do this, but if he did it, I've been watching Robert now for 40 years. It's likely that he'll go to Pioneer or somebody like them and say, I have this wonderful technology called Typhoon that's not understood by the world. But as an example, BHP and Rio and Zijin like it. So maybe you guys might like it too. And what I would propose to you is an earn-in where I do a small private placement in Pioneer to keep them alive. And then I do an exploration joint venture utilizing Pioneer, for which I charge the joint venture a fee so that if he puts $10 million in the ground over 3 years, he recoups $2.5 million by way of typhoon fees. The idea being, Robert understands that Robert Friedland's own imprimatur, his kiss, his golden kiss, is worth something. If he
Yeah,
gets
absolutely.
involved in something, if he gets involved in something, the sentiment around it changes. And Robert has learned over the last 25 years to charge for that.
Yeah,
It's
absolutely.
just
Why
the
not?
name more than the money
Yeah.
sometimes.
African Pioneer, Extract Resources, Galileo, they're all the ones that have got the licenses that between him and the Angolan border. And I can see exactly what you're saying. I think that is a great possibility, really, that they would go into a JV. And yeah, if that is the case, those stocks will still do very well, I would imagine.
I mean, listen, I really, really, really like that piece of geology. I really like that piece of geology. I have no idea who's going to be successful. I don't know how they're going to be successful. If something goes wrong politically in Zambia in the next year and those market caps fall by half, I'll probably cover the waterfront with bets. My entry point is always, if I can arrange it, catastrophe. And
I
Zambia is pretty good at delivering catastrophe.
sorry, I'm going to jump in catastrophe because it kind of describes alpha men at the moment in the Congo. And I guess I'm going to rack your brains because I bought the dip for my sins. Because I look at that mine and I look at the company, I think when this violence it concludes, that share price is going to shoot back up. But It's a nerve-wracking bet, is what it feels like at the moment.
Well, you have to right size the bet. As you probably know, I have been a shareholder in Alphamin since long before it was public. So I've been in that for a very long time, and I've been in it for the right reasons. I know the geology. I like the geology. I know the people. I like the people. I'm not fond of where it is, but you're
No.
not. They don't
The point is perfect.
put the world's best tin deposit in the suburbs of Reno or anything like that. That's not how God worked. Well, let me give you a brief story. As a young man, I was a very young man, 19 years old, 20 years old. I was a shareholder in a small penny company in Vancouver called Afton Mines, which made a big copper discovery. And I remember going to my economic geology professor in second year and saying, well, I was just talking to these stockbrokers, and they tell me that I should sell the stock because we're heading into winter. There's going to be no news. And I remember the professor saying, Rick, that copper was probably emplaced 55 million years ago. The winter season won't make too much difference to the copper. So the question is, how much difference will it make to you? That's germane to Alphamin, just like the Katanga conflict was in 1996, in the sense that the tin doesn't care how stupid the people above ground are. It's not going anywhere. So you need to manage your own emotions. If M23 and Kagame decide that they would like to steal more of that deposit, that's a risk you run. The question is very much like Panama. You don't know really what the outcome is going to be. You don't know how long it's going to take. You have to acquaint yourself with the potential risk, the potential reward, the time frame involved, and you have to do the calculus based on something other than feelings.
Pretends that this conflict will resolve itself. It just
I mean, I
happens.
believe
But
that they've probably unlocked a third of the geological potential there. So I think it'll be producing not for my mortal life, but rather for yours.
Absolutely. Rick, I want to talk to you about just quickly about Sovereign Metals, because they announced this week that they completed a placement to raise 40 million Aus dollars. Approximately 25.3 million US. What do you make of that news?
I bought as much of that placement as I was allowed.
Thought you might.
I was fairly substantially cut back, which I wasn't happy about, by the way. Some of the brokers at least went around saying, like Rick rules in the financing, and using my name to sell the financing, then cutting me back, I thought was anyway.
Expletive.
Sovereign ticks a lot of boxes for me. I like perceived political risk. I like deposits in out-of-favor commodities, but I particularly like deposits with in excess of $20 billion in recoverable resources and reserves. Deposits that should be in the lowest cost quartile in their commodity worldwide, and that should be in the best quartile in terms of return on capital employed in their sector, or at least 25%. And Sovereign ticks all of those. When you talk to most people about what Sovereign proposes to produce, they can't spell those materials, much less care about the markets for them. The exception, of course, being Rio Tinto, who are not bad folks. I mean, I suspect what will happen ultimately is that it'll be de-risked and gobbled by Rio, and I'll get a double rather than a 10-bagger. You know what? Doubles are good.
Rick, based on the fact that they've raised now, when do you anticipate? I know from looking at the documentation, Rio have basically got sort of the end of the year and then early next year before they have to make a decision. Do you anticipate being a major moving like a snail? That's probably likely, or do you think it's gonna be before then?
I have absolutely no idea. I've given up trying to understand things that I don't think I have a durable competitive advantage trying to understand. I think the likely outcome is that Rio takes it over someday. I hope that's not the ultimate outcome, because I think 5 years from now, that company could be worth 10 times what it's worth today. If Rio takes it over, the certain money will replace the big money. I'm okay with certain money or big money. Meanwhile, Malawi could deliver you an unpleasant surprise. You
Yeah,
know,
absolutely.
Malawi's not a society that's long cash. And here's an asset that would be very, very, very attractive to steal on the installment plan. That's what governments do, of course.
Yeah. Tell me, the last time we talked, or possibly it was even the previous time we talked, you talked about copper in Morocco. We have one of the companies we deal with, which is Aterian, which has quite a large group of licenses in Morocco for copper. But give us your thoughts on Morocco as a jurisdiction and whether it be copper. I'm going to bring you on to silver as well now because silver's just hit $35. And I know you're not a big silver fan, but there you go. I've been buying some physical silver. You'd be proud of me.
I am a Morocco fan. I'm a fan of the geology. I'm also a fan of the sociology. I am, and have been for some years, a shareholder of Aya. In Strata and other companies, I've been involved in mineral exploration unsuccessfully thus far in Morocco for, I don't know, 15 years. But the geology is pretty profound. In the case of Aya Silver, the community support that Aya has found in Morocco, the quality of the labor force that they found in Morocco, and the cooperation that they've gotten from the political elites in Morocco at a local level, at a regional level, at a national level is unbelievable. Now, in fairness, Mr. Benoit, the French Canadian guy who runs Aya, has done a good job of giving back to the community. When they had the big earthquake there a year ago, he shut the mine down, sent everybody home, said, look after your villages. The mine will take care of itself. And it's pretty clear that the central government isn't going to be able to get equipment up here to fix stuff. They're busy in the cities. So if your community needs a bulldozer or a front-end loader or an electrician, call us. We'll fix it up. You generate a lot of goodwill by being there for people when they need it. But in answer to the question, I like Morocco as an exploration destination. The first exploration success I've ever experienced there personally has been in Aya. And I've experienced mercifully with other people's money as a prospect generator, a lot of failure in Morocco.
And overall, then, what do you think is going to happen in the copper market and also the silver market? We had a conversation about silver last time, and yes, you were gold is the gold standard. But at the end of the day, if people want to buy physical stuff now, it's a lot of money to buy $3,000 an ounce for a tiny little coin. Whereas for a similar amount, you can buy a kilogram of silver.
So if you look at precious metals bull markets historically, I've been through three of them now. The market is led by gold. The fear buyer kicks off a precious metals bull market. When the momentum in the bull market attracts the generalist investor, when the price momentum in gold makes the narrative worthwhile to generalist investors, market leadership goes to silver, and silver goes further and faster. I think that we were in a stealth bull market in gold for a very long time. And we've moved into a secular bull market in gold now. If past is prologue, and I think it is, at some point in time in the next year or two, leadership changes to silver. If you are an investor, you buy gold. If you are a speculator, you begin now to move to silver. Perhaps, as you suggest, because of its lower unit cost. Perhaps because of its reputation for upside volatility. I don't know why silver outperforms gold midway through a market. I just know that in the three precious metals bull markets I've lived through in my life, that it has.
Have you seen in those bull markets the ratio this stretched in terms of silver and gold, or even maybe more stretched? I don't know.
The ratios make no sense to me. The idea that price should be determined by the relative scarcity of the material in the Earth's surface makes no sense. It's utility. Remember that most silver that's mined isn't mined in silver mines. It's produced as an adjunct in copper mines or gold mines or lead mines or zinc mines, which means that the production cost for the most part is zero, unlike gold. So any correlation other than psychological between the gold-silver ratio and the price ratio between the two doesn't make any sense to me. A different ratio that maybe makes more sense in a psychological, from a psychological point of view, is that at least in a nominal sense, gold is broken out to all-time highs, and silver still trades at two-thirds of all-time highs. If you get away from nominal pricing, which is to say in real pricing, neither gold nor silver is close to their real all-time highs, but silver is at a much deeper discount than gold.
Inflation adjusted. I wonder what is the gold all-time high really? What should it be?
Should it be?
That
Would
would
be
be
in the
fairly easy to
80s, wouldn't
figure
it?
out, but I'll leave it to a young, smart person with a programmable calculator
I
to
think
do.
if I remember, it was something like, was it the 850 in the 80s or something like that in terms of adjusted?
In 1981, it was $850 an ounce at the peak.
And you also have to compare it to the market capitalizations of companies as well and bond values. It's not just absolute. But I mean, the thing is, gold is at record highs, copper's at record highs, equities are at record highs. But I mean, I can't help but look at, for example, the lithium market or the nickel market. A couple of years ago, lithium was, rocketing ahead. Now it's right at the bottom. Is that what we should really be looking at, of the lithium juniors, the lithium producers?
There's not enough hate in the lithium market yet. I mean,
Are we not quite there yet?
you're thinking exactly correctly. You need to court hate to make money in this business. But lithium companies can still raise money. There's still development capital available for lithium. There's still OEM manufacturers that are putting money into lithium. And the primary factor in driving the lithium price up wasn't a shortage of raw lithium. The
It's
price of
Chinese
lithium went
subsidies.
up fivefold when SQM said at current prices that they had 85 years of reserves on their books. The problem was a shortage of refining and processing capacity, which has now been addressed. My suspicion is, we went out and we found probably, I don't know, 100, 150 lithium deposits worldwide. Probably 8 or 10 of them go in production. And so the hate from the jilted lovers, the people who overpaid for the 90 projects that won't go into production, needs to find its way into the market to depress the prices of the 8 or 10 that will. And I don't think that probably occurs till 27. The fly in the ointment, and I don't know how to price it, is direct lithium extraction.
The new
Both
tech.
Berkshire Hathaway and ExxonMobil say that they will be able to economically recover lithium from saltwater brines.
Do we believe them, though? I guess this is a
Pardon?
question.
Do we
Do we
believe them?
believe them? Do we believe that
Well,
technology works?
betting against Buffett and Exxon, I don't know. I mean, if you have your choice between believing Exxon or believing some schmuck who runs Outback Lithium, a guy who failed in the gold business, failed in the marijuana business, failed in the crypto business, and now he assures you that he's going to outthink Exxon and outthink Buffett in the lithium business. I suspect that credibility on the heavy end of the scale goes to Exxon as opposed to the schmuck in WA. It doesn't always work that way, but as a betting man,
I only asked because my early, well, back in 2019, I invested in Pilbara Minerals, and that's pretty much where I rode the wave all the way to the top. That's fantastic, but is it going to be another wave? That's the hope. That's the dream. But that's my last question for
What I
you.
think will happen is that the 8 or 10 best deposits will act like sovereign. The value will be there. The market will hate them. And if you buy them, if you endure 2 or 3 years of hate and volatility, that you'll get a triple, a very, very low risk triple. Now, the people who are attracted to lithium are people that have visions of sugar plums. The idea of a 3-year triple to them, what they want is a 10 bagger over a long weekend. And they think that what they want matters. That's useful too, because you're competing against a brain dead counterparty.
Rick, one last question. One of our best producing stocks is mainly owned by Power Metals, which is Guardian Metal Resources. Which is the tungsten deposit in Nevada. Has it come onto your radar yet, this tungsten
No,
business, or are
no,
you
no,
still not
no,
interested
no.
in it?
No, power metals is of interest to me because they're involved in the private to public transformation, something that served me very well when I was a young man that I no longer have time to do. So the idea that they do it for me and I participate indirectly is great. I have zero interest in small deposits.
Yeah.
Uh, my belief is that a small mine makes you small money, a big mine makes you big money. But they both have the same level of risk. And the idea that I should take big risk for small money, I'm not interested.
Absolutely. Rick, I obviously want to, thank you for coming on because, giving your time up is very generous of you. And I just want to leave with this. There's something I saw a quote online that says, "Life is strange. We come with nothing and fight for everything. And in the end, we leave everything and go with nothing." And basically, I know you do a lot of giving in the form of, philanthropic work and mentoring, but just how important for you is leaving that kindness and legacy for others?
It's extremely important. When the second of my wife and I die, basically the entire estate goes to philanthropy. It took me 45 years to be learn how to be a good investor. I'm not yet a good philanthropist. I've been at it now for 20 years, but I'm getting better. Meanwhile, I've learned that I can invest my own time, mentoring, providing money to outfits like Students for Liberty, trying to make the world a better place. Well, let younger people make the world a better place without me having to do it, them doing it. I also am making money now in the education business, in rural investment media, and in particular in the rural classroom. We've schooled over 10,000 people with our free instructional programming at the rural classroom. My hope is that by the time I shed my mortal coil, 20 or 30,000 people will have completed the coursework at the rural classroom. And whether they employ the knowledge or not, they will have the ability to differentiate between the good, the bad, and the ugly in natural resource stock markets. That's very, very important to me.
Do you think the modern day speculator investor has the patience that you've had to learn over the last number of years?
Pareto's law works, 20% of the people become tolerably good, 4% of the people become very good, and 1% of the people become exceptional. It's wild. In my 20s, when I had all the time left on Earth, I was really impatient. Now in my 70s, let's just say winter is nigh, I've become much more patient, although I have less time on Earth. It isn't because I didn't want immediate gratification. It's because I learned it's not available. I've made my money in 5 or 6 year turns. Yes, occasionally I've had a stock that moved before that. But really, when I look back at the 10 baggers that I've enjoyed, or the 20 baggers, or the 30 baggers, almost all of them have required 5 or 6 years. And by the way, almost all of them have delivered me 50% share price declines during the period of time I owned them. So, in addition to being persistent, I have to be tenacious. As a young man, I wished it wasn't so, and I thought that my wishes had consequences, which they don't. In my declining years, having done this for a very long time, I've learned what works, and time works. Work works. Hope fails.
Very good. Very good.
Time.
We're going to call time on that note and say, obviously, Rick Rule, President and CEO of Rule Investment Media, thanks very much for appearing back on the podcast.
Well, I want to say one more thing. I've graded a lot of portfolios. I've taught a lot. I've learned a lot. Any of your listeners who like what I have to say about natural resources, or even if you don't and you're curious, go to my website, Rule Investment Media. List your natural resource stocks, and I'll personally rank them. Understand my rankings are snapshots in time. Something could change a week from now that changes the ranking. Go to Rule Investment Media, list your natural resource stocks, I'll rank them. Absolutely, no cost, no obligation. Because there's no cost, of course, there's a money-back guarantee. Give me 10 days. I'm about 250 rankings behind right now. But once again, Rule Investment Media, list your natural resource stocks, I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. I'll comment on individual issues if I think my comments have value.
Brilliant. That's excellent. Well, that's an offer you can't refuse, listeners. So thanks again, Rick.
Thank you.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best performer I've got this week is Premier African Minerals, up some 154%. What news have you? Has there been anything out, Charles, or has this just been riding on the back of a wave of buyers?
Well, it's the leakiest stock on AIM, I would say. So we don't, there's been no official news that we don't know if there's any new news. The basic point with Prem is that the debt that they have, the offtake prepayment debt that they have with Canmax, the long stop date is on the 1st of April, so that is on Tuesday, at which point Canmax potentially will call in the debt and the company collapses, or that debt is converted into equity into the flagship asset of Zulu, and then most of their debt gets wiped out, and then the stock theoretically should rise pretty sharply. It's a binary play, a binary, very high-risk gamble, but there's a significant number of people looking at that share price down at sort of 0.001, 0.002, 0.003, thinking, well, this is a good risk-to-reward play at this level. I guess we'll find out next week whether they were right.
Absolutely. European Metal Holdings, EMH. You mentioned this one to me earlier in the week. They had an announcement related to the Sinovec. They're declaring the strategic project under the EU Critical Minerals Raw Materials Act. What did you make of that news?
Yeah, so basically, there was, actually I'm writing an article about it at the moment, but there was 40, I think it was 47 critical minerals projects in Europe, and we're given strategic project status, which basically means that they get streamlined, faster permitting, access to better finance, access to finance to grant funding as well. And European Metal Holdings, obviously, they got this news, stock shot up. Other companies like Zinnwald, who were expecting it and weren't on the list, went down. Some companies it was already priced in. What I think is more interesting for people listening now, and this is on Mother's Day, so other projects outside of Europe have applied for this status, but they're going to be announced most likely next quarter. So they're outside of actually the continent of Europe. So you've got Greenrock, for example, which you guys will know, or Blencow Resources, or HARENA, which recently I RTO'd. These companies, I believe, have all applied. And, will they get it? Will they not? I mean, there are some companies like Zinnwald that you thought would get it and haven't. Some that like European Metals, who we didn't really think, and then they've shot up. So those three are on my radar at the moment because they've got very low market caps, could shoot up next quarter should they get it. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, there was another good bit of news this week regarding Incantera. There was an announcement related to the resolution of allegations of patent infringement, and effectively it looks like the company has now detailed discussions with the third party, a confidential settlement agreement, which has been reached inter alia, providing legal certainty. There has been no patent infringement and no legal proceedings will be started or issued against the company in relation to the skin plus cell in the future. So great news for Incantera. What did you make of that, Kev?
Yeah, I thought it was good that it's now sorted out, and yeah, they can move forward. Hopefully, sell the products that they have, and the Immufarm warrants that they put off for 6 months. You wouldn't have believed it at the time because they were massively in the money when they paid the extra $65,000 or pounds, I think it was. They're now still in the money. Incantera is in and around the 12p, and I think the warrants is 9 or 9.5p. I can't remember the exact figure. So I'm fully expecting those to be transacted, and also, let's see what comes up because they must have been doing something during all of this period of time. So let's hope there's going to be some announcements. I think you're going to have news-rich period of time here from those guys.
Yeah, I
And I
mean,
spoke
one
to
of the things.
Tim was away in Spain visiting his son, so we said we'd catch up with him next week. So yeah, watch this space. We'll have an interview with him next week, probably.
Yeah, and they wrote in the RNS, didn't they, that the agreement that's in place now obviously enables the company to progress its plans to bring the skin cell to market, as we've said. And the company's currently engaged in discussions with multiple groups exploring various market entry strategies with the potential for global reach. So things still going on in the background there by the looks of things on the RNS.
I mean, this is exactly what I said would happen with I'm sorry, with Encantara, which is basically somebody has come along, with a complaint about the patent at the time of maximum damage, and it's been settled now. We don't know whether they had, a realistic claim or not, but basically, effectively, they've been paid off. It might be there's a royalty, it might be a one-off payment, but now you're exactly back to the same investment proposition it was when the share price was much higher, and it can recover. Simple as that. So basically, I mean, the biggest thing is the products will go on the shelves at Marriott, and people will like them or they won't. And I say that, with no prejudice, because there's plenty of products go on the shelves which you think are really good and they work in the lab and they just don't work. And then there are other ones that go on and they just sell like hotcakes. And hopefully we've got a hotcake one.
Another one I want to mention this week is Alien Metals. Charles, the UFO, there's the ticker, Alien Metals. They're about 40, 50% on the week. What happened there? There was some sort of was it JV partner, was it with Silver Agreement?
Yeah, so basically, they've got several assets, but the silver asset, which is the Elizabeth Hill silver mine and surrounding tenements, was previously Australia's highest grade silver mine. It only closed down 20 years ago because the silver price fell to $5. Now we're at sort of $34 or so. So that asset has been joint ventured or vended into Errawarra, which is going to be renamed to West Coast Silver. They've raised 3 million Australian dollars. Errawarra is going to go drill that asset for high grade silver. And on the day that happened, Errawarra was the highest riser in the ASX across the whole index, which goes to show actually kind of exciting because this silver asset wasn't on AIM for a long time. It moved to the ASX and then just shot up immediately, right? Alien retains a significant exposure to that silver asset through the joint venture, but also got a significant amount of capital in. Around 800,000 Australian dollars, which should be enough to buy time to get a joint venture for its flagship asset, the Hancock Iron Ore Project. And therefore, basically, you kill two birds with one stone. You've got a very popular joint venture, and you've also got a lot of cash into the company. And so it shoots up. And the fingers crossed, we'll get Hancock over the line later this year. And should you do that, then all the iron ore DSO producers in that area of Australia have done really, really well. And as a risk company, it's one to watch.
Absolutely. Good. Celadon, Kev, there was an announcement this week on Celadon. I think they dropped back a bit regarding they're effectively going to be run as a private company. Just give us an update on that one.
Yeah, again, I had a conversation with Jim. I think it's just the vagaries of the market and also what's actually happened with doing cannabis on the UK stock market. They just can't do it. They just don't know the regulation, everything else. They just cannot do it. It's just much easier to run it as a private company. My view is personally that he's going to run it as a private company and then list it in the US in the future. Yeah, so you still got your shares, by the way. You're just going to be listed in a private company. You'll be able to trade them through a platform, and yeah, that's it. It'll be going off the market, I think, once a vote has occurred. I mean, the vote has to occur first. But for me, I'm holding on to it, and I've actually been a buyer this week because I think it's got the potential to be a massive company in the future. And when it doesn't have to deal with all these shenanigans that's had to deal with, then I think it's going to be in a great place.
Very good. Charles, anything else you want to talk about this week?
I mean, on the flip side, that Guardian Metal just continues to keep hit record high
Hi,
after
yeah.
record high every day. Helped along by Trump, the tungsten story. It's just enjoyable to see a winner run, right?
Yeah,
Then,
absolutely. Yeah. The gift that just keeps on giving. I sent Oliver a message when it was about to go through 50. I said to him, "This is tight as a duck's arse and getting tighter." And then that's when it went 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, I think was the highest that was paid for on Thursday. I don't know what it's going to finish the week at, but we will see. We will see. But what? Why do you think this is happening? Is the best question to ask Charles, because people hold their stock when they think it's got more to give. But you know, it's 500% up already. You know, I mean, when you
It's
look at it.
the thing is mostly generally people just top slice their shares as it goes up, and that creates liquidity. And that, by the way, that is a smart thing to do generally. I mean, most people have, all of us will have had stocks which were up 1,000% and we didn't sell any, and then we lost all our gains, right? And you hope that doesn't happen because you're hoping it will go higher, you always do. But with Guardian, we have this, it's not unique, but it's a rare situation where you can, ACAM, if you like, owns roughly a quarter of a company. Pure Bond owns a decent number of shares. There's a few individuals like Chagan Tanmani, who's strategic advisor, who also owns a lot of shares. And then there's high net worth individuals who are not TR1 holders, but who I know personally, who are holding a significant number. And nobody is selling. And then you have retail, and whether you look on LSE or Telegram groups or Twitter, and this is probably Oliver, his marketing capability, but also his personality and his work ethic. Retail isn't selling either. So I have, I'll happily say this. I have personally been called by my broker asking whether I'd be selling, I could sell shares a few days ago. And I said, no, I don't want to sell them. I'm quite happy right now. And I know others have been called and asked as well. So I don't want to use the term short squeeze because I'm not sure people are short, but people want to buy the stock and there's no stock available. And so
Yeah,
eventually,
it's not.
it's simple as that.
Don't. Yeah, I don't think it's a short squeeze. I think people just want the stock. It's in demand, isn't it? And normally, when a stock is in demand, it normally means that people have the impression this could go, you know, it
Higher and
could double, it
higher.
could treble, it could double, it could treble, it could quadruple. You know,
I'm
I mean, I saw somebody, one of the guys who's I've seen his posts before. I don't remember the guy's name, but very very astute, or seems very astute, and he's saying he's adding at this stage because he sees you know that 200, 300, 400 million pound market cap for this for these assets
Well, I think
is not beyond the pale.
it's not really the assets.
However,
It's the fact that Oliver is now trying to corner the North American tungsten market in a world where Trump wants to be 100% reliant only on domestic assets, which he's put in an executive order a few days ago. But in terms of the selling, the only other thing I will say of the selling, because those broker calls are very rare. And this is just my speculation, so I could be completely wrong, but I'm imagining it's an institution who, because the scale of the move in the speed of time, kind of like Andrade recently, it just feels like it's not retail going after it, it's an institution that wants more. I don't know whether that's
It's
ACAM or if it's someone else.
gone from 32 to 52 in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks.
Right. So that's an institution, it seems to me. It doesn't mean it definitely is, but that's institutional price action. That's not, people at home behind their computer, in my view.
I don't think it's beyond the pale that it will go up to the 70p, and that'll put the accelerators on the
On the
warrants,
warrants, yeah.
which will put it in an even better position.
Well, I think this is an interesting one because it's pretty commonly known that when a stock hits a 50 million market cap, there's a load of funds that will not buy your stock until you hit 50 million. And so, is there an institution out there who's like, right, we're going to get it to 50 million? And that's the question. But I think what I will say to people, looking at it now at this record high with everything going fantastically well, I am not selling my stock. However, I have a diversified portfolio. And I do know there's a few people out there who have put everything they have into this company. Just that's not a good idea for any one stock. But if you're going to pick one, this is not a bad one to bet on.
Good one, yeah. We did there's two interviews that went out in the week as well, so well worth catching up on those. Technology Minerals, we talked to Alex Stanbury, so have a listen, look on the dashboard, have a look at that, the midweek takeaway, and there's also Energy Pathways with Ben Clue. So two RNSs. Again, we can't really talk too much in detail about them here, but obviously if you want to catch up on those, please do search them out. And yeah, obviously it's been a long show. Grand Prix last week, did anybody see the action, the Formula One from China? I mean, McLaren are absolutely dominating it so far, one and two. Hamilton and Leclerc were with di double disqualification. I mean, it had everything really. It was a fantastic race. I don't know if you watched it, but it was very, very good.
No.
No, okay. Football's your forte, Kev. What about we got the football?
I think I was too busy being in depression from the fact that Liverpool got knocked out of the Champions
Was that
League,
why you haven't talked to me for that?
and
Yeah,
we
exactly.
lost we lost the Carabao Cup to Newcastle, which congratulations, Newcastle supporters.
And what else
I
have you
am
lost this
actually
week, Kev? What else have you
very
lost
happy
this
for you. We haven't lost him yet, but Trent Alexander's off to Madrid
Oh, no.
to go and see his boyfriend,
Kev's got
Jude
no more
Bellingham.
tears left to cry.
Yeah. As long as we don't lose Salah and Van Dijk, I'll be a happy bunny because he's going to be missed for sure. But some of the rhetoric around him leaving is like he sold his granny by the fact that he's left. So I think it's a bit over the top. I understand why the guy's going, but at the same time, when you've got red blood and you've got, you cut you open and it says you'll never walk alone, then you'll never walk alone,
Some
But
of
I
the
think,
rhetoric, mate, on social media about is like some of the fans are saying we want to forfeit the title so he doesn't get a title and all this. I'm like, dude, come on.
No, there was one thing said, right, like, I want him. He's not in the squad for the rest of the season. He's not going on the bus. He's not getting the medal. He's not. And the funniest was that the corner against Barcelona that he did, and Divock Origi scored the equaliser, I think it was, or the fourth goal. And they've changed him out. He's now it's not Alexander Arnold now. It's either the other left back or Endo or whoever it happens to be, Robertson or Endo. And then the other statement was, and the corner wasn't really that quick after all.
Oh my
So,
word.
yeah, emotions are running high in Scouseland because our Scouser is off to Madrid. By the looks of things, I mean, it's not certainty, but I think it's 99.9% now. So, yeah,
Excellent.
I wish him well, but just
Yeah.
don't come back to Anfield.
Well, given 3 years, I'll be in Saudi Arabia with the rest of them, so I wouldn't worry about too
No,
much.
the funny thing is, if you look back at his past interviews, some of the things he said over the years was, I just want to be with Liverpool. I want to play with Liverpool. I want to be the captain of Liverpool. I want to do this. I want to do that. And yeah, he was a young lad and a young kid at that stage. But he's had his head turned. Simple as that. He's had his head turned and he's off to Madrid. He's going to get himself life-changing money as a signing on fee, I would imagine. Probably 30, 40, 50 million quid and 10 to 15 million pounds a year. So can you blame him?
Yeah. Good. Well, I think we've talked long enough. It was a great roast that this week. I mean, Rick's brilliant, isn't he? Some of his insights and the knowledge and the way he's just the way he's a great raconteur, isn't he, Rick? That the storytelling is brilliant. So I really enjoy having him on as a guest. And of course,
It is.
you as well, Charles, you know. And so on that note, I think we'll say, yeah, that's not sarcasm. If you
No, that's
like,
all right, mate. It's fine. I'm here every week.
And I would just say to everybody who's listening, don't be disappointed with the fact that you are investing in small stocks and hoping for not a miracle, but certainly a 10 bagger, a 20 bagger, a 30 bagger. Because Rick's a multi-millionaire, and now he can invest in those stocks,
Oh, come on. I asked him
and he
that
enjoys it.
question. Nah, because his advice is, oh no, do your safe stuff and then do your mid-cap stuff and then take a risk. And then you ask him, how do you make your money when you were running young Rick? And he threw it all in risk assets, just like we all
Exactly.
do, because it's the only way you can win. And then once you've got 5 million in the bank, oh, you can just put it in a nice relaxing Rio Tinto. There's no stress at all. But anyway,
Yeah.
very good.
Absolutely.
All right, on that note, thanks for listening. Please do subscribe, hit the bell icon for any future notifications of further episodes, and have a great weekend. Look after your mothers. Look after your mothers.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.